I am exhausted. Nothing to do with making a baby or even practicing. Just been on the road and averaging about 4 hours sleep a night. On the podcast this week, fucked if I even know. it's my interview with Kat, my gorgeous, kind, non-monogamous friend who sees the world in many ways the same as I. It's my unconventional life. Running on fumes.
I went to the woods because I wanted to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. My name is Nigel McGuinness, and this is My Unconventional Life. It's a podcast, it's a journal, and in a way, it is kind of a personal ad. But most of all, it's about navigating the treacherous waters of love, sex, and relationships in 2017. Sponsored by absolutely no one. Every week, I detail my own journey and discuss my own untraditional views and aspirations in that world. Whatever the topic, whoever the guest, it all comes back to one question. How do we best find and express love in 2017? About 9 days so far, about 5 more to go. It's not the travelling or living out of a suitcase that really bothers me, it's the lack of sleep. But ultimately, that was somewhat my choice, as I did hang out with friends instead of going to bed. So what can you do? You reap what you sow, I guess. I have tried to keep in touch with Eri while I'm away to maintain our dialogue and rapport. Not easy. Same with the lovely girl that I went on a date with before I left. There are, of course, opportunities, in quotation marks, on the road. But I'll be honest, they just never seem to materialise for me. Part of it, while I don't feel monogamy is the right choice for me, I'm just not really interested in casual sex either. I mean, the idea of sex without any communication, connection, or trust just doesn't seem to vibe with me. I'm a bit of an anomaly, perhaps. It seems I have sex a lot less with a lot fewer people than a lot of the monogamous people I know. Isn't that an almost universal theme, though? Everybody's having more sex than me. I wonder what the average amount is. Hold on, let me press pause and I'll be right back. Just looked it up. The average person has sex 103 times a year. So I've got a lot of catching up to do. On the subject of my libido, I've noticed that if I apply the testosterone cream first thing in the morning when I wake up, I feel my libido a lot more significantly than if I apply it later in the day after working out and showering. Either way, it's kind of redundant because I'm stopping taking it soon and starting the fertility meds to boost my sperm production, in case I decide to move forward and start trying with Eri in a couple of months. Exciting times, people. Right, the interview this week is with my friend Kat. Kat is beautiful, but she gets told that all the time. What's really appealing to me about her is that she's kind, thoughtful, sensitive, and open-minded. I met her first through both of us being in wrestling, but our genuine friendship has developed largely outside of it. She is one of the enduring fwobs in my life, a friend without benefits. Girls for who, whatever reason, either they're not attracted to me, I'm not attracted to them, they have a boyfriend, or we've just been friend-zoned, who are platonic friends, just platonic friends, but we hang out, hold hands, I give them massages or take them on dates, or we cuddle watching movies, to basically fulfill the basic human need for love and physical affection without complicating it with sex. I don't know what it says about me, but I've always been able to cultivate them easily. Perhaps because, as Mark Manson puts it in his book, I'm not needy about it. And also, perhaps because girls have so fewer societal judgments about that stuff. It truly is a shame, though, that the simple act of sex can be so stigmatized and come with so many caveats for us to be able to have and really enjoy it. Anyway, I digress. Here is Kat. Okay, it is Sunday afternoon. I am in North Hollywood with one of my dearest and most attractive friends, Kat.
Yay, hello, thank you for having me and thank you for saying such a nice thing.
I always say nice things about you, but that's because you're such a lovely person and we've been friends for a long time now, haven't we? How long?
We have. Well, it must be about 10, a bit more than 10 years.
Let me think. The first time I saw you was in England.
Yes.
At a Ring of Honor show. Mm-hmm. And then you came to America and yes. You were in Louisville at the same time.
Yeah, and I arrived there in sort of the second half of 2006, so that would be when we became friends.
Right, and I remember taking you out to an art exhibit in Louisville, was that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the Art Walk.
The Art Walk of Louisville,
and
yeah.
There was free wine
yeah,
and lots of art.
Right, and I tried to get you drunk.
Did you?
no.
And thank you, Dan. Yeah. I was going to say, I must not have tried hard. It was easy to get me drunk in those days.
But you don't drink anymore.
I don't drink at all anymore. I quit almost 5 years ago.
Wow, 5 years sober, huh?
Yes.
How's that been?
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I will say there's two tricks to being sober,
uh-huh. You
know, if you really want to or think it's a good idea for you. Number one is to have a big enough incentive not to do it.
Yeah.
And the second is to replace it with something.
Ah.
And so for me, the replacement has been creative fulfillment. So it's been writing and producing my own things, which I wasn't doing before.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you're always partying and things, you don't really
yeah.
have the focus and the time then to do that.
Right.
And so, but it was something that I always wanted to do. And then now it's natural for me to, when I have spare time, to write and come up with ideas and things like that.
Yeah.
Yes.
So your inspiration and what you replaced it with was essentially the same thing?
No.
No? Well, what was your inspiration? If you're...
You mean why I quit?
Yeah.
Well, because I was just, I couldn't control it. So it wasn't like I couldn't do moderation. It was always too much.
You're not a good drunk.
And I'm not a good drunk. Bad things would happen.
Like Caitlin.
And it came to the point where I thought, well, things are not getting better. They're decelerating.
Yeah.
As it were. So if I stop completely, then, you know, I'll find something else to do with my life, which I did. So.
Right. I think alcoholics call it a moment of clarity, right?
Right.
Caitlin, who I interviewed for the podcast, I think there was a moment she was in a car, there was no gas in the car, and she just woke up at like 8 o'clock in the morning, didn't know where she was, and that was her moment of clarity when she stopped and went to AA and sort of got her life back on track. So,
yeah. I mean, for her, the same thing, she's done incredibly well.
Yeah.
And she's working so hard on so many different things, it's really an inspiration to me too.
It is crazy, isn't it? Yeah, when you think about it, how readily available alcohol is.
Mm-hmm.
And how much damage it causes society, you know?
I think it's one of the most dangerous drugs that is, period, full stop. You know, because, and partly because it is so accessible and also because it's so accepted.
Yeah.
So
expected almost.
Yeah. So if you're out at night and you're drunk, that's normal. And if you're stumbling around or even if you throw up, that's reasonably normal.
Yeah. And if you don't drink, like I don't drink really, I mean, I'll have a drink from time to time, but when I do, it's almost always to try to fit in and not to be like a social outcast because everybody else is having a drink. Go on, have a beer.
Right.
Have a beer. Go on, just one drink. And if I said, well, actually, I'm an alcoholic and I'm sober, okay, I understand it. But if I'm not,
right,
and I just don't want to drink because I don't really enjoy it, well, that's weird. What's wrong with you?
Right.
You know, it's still, it is interesting, the expectations that society has for us.
And it is. Yeah, and it's also partly because people don't want to drink alone, so they feel better if you do it as well.
Mm.
You know, but interesting, I mean, I like to be around people that have a drink or two, interestingly. I do enjoy that, and I get a sort of a contact high when I'm around a group of people and they're drinking.
Hmm, that's interesting, because for me, there's only been two people who I liked as much when they were drunk as when they were sober. The majority of people, I'm perfectly okay with them drinking, no problems whatsoever. It's kind of funny, a little bit here and there, but after a while, it kind of gets a little bit long in the tooth. But my dad and Spider Nate Webb were the two people who I just thought, and maybe that just speaks because I love them both and they were both such wonderful people that when they got drunk, it would just be themselves, but exemplified. And
right. And
that was fantastic too. But
yeah.
It is an interesting idea, isn't it, about society and what society tells us
we should do.
Yes.
And what we shouldn't do. And that obviously speaks to the idea of being monogamous and finding one person and falling in love and getting married and having children.
Right.
This is kind of the way that society, at least in our generation, sort of pointed us in that direction, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I would say monogamy was invented for practical reasons.
For example?
Because it's a breeding structure. We invented monogamy because when two people have sex, they're essentially breeding, so they're creating a baby. But back in the day, if there wasn't DNA testing or there wasn't readily available protection, then somebody would end up with a little human being and somebody had to take care of it.
Right.
So when you don't have like a structure, so for example, a nuclear family structure, where you have a man and a woman and they're married and the man has a job, and obviously the woman back then didn't have a job.
Yeah.
And then the man, because he's with her and we know that they're together, so we know it's his child, and then he takes care of her and everything's squared away.
Hmm.
But if a woman, I think that's why it was such a big deal if somebody was a bastard, because who's going to take care? Somebody has to take responsibility for the baby. And the woman, especially back then, wasn't able to, certainly.
Hmm.
So it's a burden on society. So then monogamy was invented, I believe, to combat that problem. And then it was drilled into our heads and we were conditioned then in the end. And then when we had the idea that we had free will and we fell in love with different people, then we started making it about being in love and finding the one. And that was a concept that didn't exist right away. That's, I guess, something that was invented a bit later, where you went, okay, I'm looking for the one person that I will love forever. But that was just something that we, again, invented to go with that story. And now that it's not necessary anymore, we can evolve into having different choices when it comes to our relationship structures and our breeding structures.
Right. It's an interesting idea. And I think there are many, many reasons why monogamy became the norm and the ideal. I do believe, because I did a podcast with an evolutionary biologist about 6 months ago, something like that. And I, of course, espoused non-monogamy and how pre-agriculture we were all polyamorous, et cetera, et cetera. Everything that I'd read in Sex at Dawn. Have you read Sex at Dawn?
No, not yet.
I'll give you my copy to read. It's amazing. Fantastic book. And he said, actually, that's not entirely true. He said that as human beings, we possess the capability to be both monogamous and non-monogamous. As a male, you actually have two breeding strategies, both of which are naturally and innate to you.
Right.
And it all depends on who the mate is. For example, if I am with a girl, according to this theory, and I consider her to be genetically superior to me, I will naturally, without any influence from society, want to be monogamous with her, want her not to be with anybody else, because I want to invest all of my genetics into the next generation, and it's worth it because my genes are with a better genetic match.
Right. And then also you want to prevent her from breeding with somebody else because you want your DNA to be.
However,
yes,
if I'm with a girl who I consider equal or lesser genetic value,
right,
then I don't want to be monogamous with her because from an evolutionary standpoint, it's better for me to look for other girls who are better genetically. Now, I'll still get her pregnant.
Yes.
And I may still care for her to a certain extent, but I won't want to invest fully in her.
Right.
Now, I'm not sure if I believe 100% in the case, but I do think that that emotion of wanting to be with one person and not wanting to be with somebody else is so strong that there does have to be some kind of innate desire there. I'm not sure that that could come just from social conditioning.
Right.
The real problem, which is what this guy says, is that that feeling, whether it's innate or not, usually doesn't last for more than 3 to 5 years.
Right.
And so this presents a huge fucking problem if we're trying to spend the rest of our lives with somebody.
Yes. Well, I think that theory makes perfect sense.
Mm.
Because also for a man, biologically speaking, it would be desirable because he can breed with multiple females at the same time to do that. But then again, I see how if he was with somebody that he considered genetically superior, that he wanted to make sure that she was the one to carry his seed.
Yeah.
Whereas for a woman, it's a bit different because we can only carry one.
Right.
We can only breed with one person at the same time. So for us to have somebody who will be monogamous with us and then take care of us whilst we're pregnant and protect us from whatever's out there in the wild trying to kill us and helps nurture us and feed us while we're physically not as strong,
yeah,
is more desirable.
Right.
Then.
But if you look beyond the sex and the making babies and stuff like that, you do believe that you can love more than one person at the same time as well, right?
I mean, 100,000%, yeah. Right. I think you can be in love with several people too.
Right. The notion that it's not true love unless it's just with one person, and that if you is true love, you don't want to be with anybody else, and you don't want them to be with anybody else, I think is disingenuous, right? Now, perhaps some people do truly feel that way innately, but I think there are some people that don't. I'm often told, well, you just haven't found the right person yet.
Oh,
if you
too.
Found the right person, that's how you'd feel.
Right. But yes, but I get told that as well all the time. But I don't believe that either because it's still a choice. I mean, I know people that are very happily monogamous and they, you know, they made that choice for themselves in some cases quite deliberately.
Yeah.
And in some cases, obviously, you just meet someone and you sort of do that whole, I'm in love.
Right.
It's romantic. And you have the idea that that's how it's supposed to be anyways.
Yeah.
And also, the other thing is, too, if you look at the animal kingdom, and I know people don't like to think about that, but we are still animals on some level. If you look into the animal kingdom, there's different animals that breed in different ways, too.
Yeah.
So there's some that mate for life. And I'm sure they also feel love and affection for each other. And then there's some that don't mate for life. And why shouldn't it be amongst humans? Shouldn't there be different people that have different desires and genetic
propensities? It's the same as, you know, it's the same as sexuality. You know, you got to say, okay, people are either straight or they're gay. Or perhaps there's these bisexual people as well. But it's all a sliding scale. And I think it's the same thing with relationships as well. Perhaps there are. I think there are some people who are known as pair bonders. That's what Rachel calls them. That, yes, for whatever reason, that's the way they're hardwired. But by the same token, there's people who aren't.
Yeah.
And to say that the love that those people feel is somehow less than people who are pair bonders, I think is unfair. I think, and it's really limiting because, let's be honest, if you look at the world, most people probably aren't suited to be with one person for the rest of their lives.
Right.
They're just not. I mean, if you, and it's not just looking at yourself and going, oh, I've been hurt and I've had my heart broken. You look at the world, you look at so many people.
Yeah.
I think you've got to look at it that way and just say that, you know, monogamy should be a possibility.
Right.
But perhaps it should be the exception rather than the norm. Right.
And yes, and then not to mention that because we are so, let's say, conditioned to think of monogamy as the default setting or as the best choice.
Right.
A lot of people, as you know, as everybody knows, I'm sure, will stay in relationships for much, much longer than they should, even though they're not really in love anymore. Or one person's still in love, the other person's not in love. But if they break up with you, then it's, oh, you're throwing the relationship away, or you're dumping me, or you're doing something bad, you know. Or even if you are in a relationship and you fall in love with somebody new and you're caught in that situation, how do I handle this because I have feelings for two people? You can't even talk about it because you're already the bad guy for feeling that way.
Yeah.
Whereas you shouldn't have to feel guilty for feeling love for anybody. But all of a sudden it's, oh, you're the bad guy. And now you have to forget that other person, stay in your relationship, work it out, and potentially be miserable for it. I mean, there's so many people that are miserable in relationships for so long. And it's tragic.
It is tragic,
partly because of the way that we have learned to look at relationships.
Right. But also because it's so difficult to be single and get your needs met. I mean, that's the truth. Whether you consider yourself non-monogamous or monogamous, to meet someone and to have your needs met in terms of companionship, in terms of connection, in terms of, you know, sexual gratification, it's not easy. It really isn't easy. And you could make an argument that it's easier for attractive girls than, you know, not attractive guys. And that's why there's so many not attractive guys on the internet, you know, trying to meet up with these attractive girls.
Yes.
But I know, I just think ultimately there has to be other options. And I think in 50 years, there will be more options.
Yes.
I mean, we're seeing already millennials are far less hardwired, are far less tied to the idea of finding one person and spending the rest of their lives together.
Right.
So I think we're going in the right direction. Yeah. But, I mean, talk to me about how you started thinking in this way, because you grew up in a relatively normal family, right?
Yes. Well, for me, there's a story attached to this.
Ooh, I like stories.
So, might sound a little bit silly. Okay, so this is back in England.
Uh-huh.
This is actually way before I even came here. I think it was when I was, maybe when I was sober for the first time.
Mm.
Incidentally, which I find interesting too. I was dating this guy that I really liked, and we had a nice relationship, and it was not, you know, overbearing. And
yeah.
It was just, we got along and everything was fine. And one day I went to an audition. And so I was early for my time, and I realized I needed to go to the bathroom. So this is all important. So, but they didn't have one. So I left the place to go and find one. And as I was walking down the street, and I'd clocked earlier an art center that I was going to go into. So I was walking towards that. And then suddenly this pub caught my eye on the side of the street. It had this red awning, and I just felt drawn to it. So I thought, let me go in there. So I walk inside, and the very first thing I see sitting on the bar is a black cat just looking at me. And I thought, whoa. So then I went in, you know, I was allowed to use the bathroom. I left. I went back to the audition. As I walk in, there's this guy sitting there that I knew from before,
uh-huh.
that I'd had a little flirtation with.
Yeah.
And he had exactly the audition slot before me, and I went, whoa, and we said hello and chatted a bit, and then he did his audition, and I did mine. When I came home, he was waiting for me and said, let's have a coffee. So I said, sure. So we're having a coffee, and then he's sort of like, hey, let's go somewhere, kind of thing. And I really wanted to.
Right.
And then I knew I couldn't.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't cheat.
Yeah.
But I realized that I really did want to. And that's when suddenly it didn't make sense to me anymore that I shouldn't do that because I'm with somebody else. And we didn't do anything. We just said goodbye, and that was fine. And, you know, I stayed with my boyfriend maybe another week or so. And then I said to him, you know what? I think I just want to be single now. And he was fine with that too. And we stayed friends and even lovers for a bit.
Great.
And that was sort of my first experience with that. And yeah, and ever since then, like anytime I've had a non-monogamous relationship, it's really been very positive.
Mm. But you've been in monogamous relationships since then?
I have, yes.
And?
Not so positive. But, as you know.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, the average person hearing that, their first instinct would be, okay, because the people you were in monogamous relationships with weren't right for you. That's why it wasn't a positive experience. But it's not necessarily that, right?
Right. It's not necessarily that. I'm sure it plays into it.
Mm.
But it's also just when I am single, I'm much more at peace with myself. And I feel that when I'm in a monogamous relationship, I change.
Yep.
And I hate what I become.
Right.
And so for me, you know, it wasn't just his fault, whoever he was, but it was partly also because I couldn't stand my ground, and I started morphing and changing to please him or to please the relationship and to do my duties as a good girlfriend kind of thing. And then I came out of it and thought, where did I go? Where am I?
Yeah.
You know, and when I'm single and I can be in a non-monogamous relationship with somebody and we can just operate on an equal platform more so, and it's about freedom and honesty, and everybody just does whatever they want, and it's fine, and you respect each other, and you spend time together, or you, if you don't, it's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, life is beautiful.
Right, just designed that way. And I think if you look through history, there has been people who've lived that way, either openly or more likely not openly, but nonetheless, I think there have been a number of people, and arguably usually the more creative, artistic types find themselves that way.
Right.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that if I have a child with someone,
yes,
it is tantamount to the same thing? that I'll in some way give up some of my autonomy, some of my independence.
For the person or for your child?
Well, both.
Well, I would think that you would have to make sacrifices for a child, but it probably wouldn't feel like a sacrifice.
Right.
So my mom, for example,
yeah,
when I was growing up, it was me and my two sisters, and then my dad and my mom split up when I was quite young.
Uh-huh.
So my mom had custody of us, and it wasn't like my dad wasn't around. He'd come around, but my mom really was the bulk of raising us, fell yeah. on her. And for example, we didn't have a lot of money, so we had a smaller apartment. There was two bedrooms. There was three children. She gave my sister her own bedroom. I mean, my younger sister shared, and my mom didn't even have her own room.
Oh, wow.
You know, she slept in the living room so that we could have more space.
Yeah.
Things like that. But then much later when it occurred to me, like, my God, she really did a lot for us. And I spoke to her about it and I said, wow, you made these sacrifices for us. And she said, well, it wasn't a sacrifice.
Yeah.
And she truly meant that. And I think, I feel, but from the type of person I think that you are, that you would be the same.
Hmm. Yeah, I think I would too. I really do think I would too. So maybe then the question then isn't about giving up some of that autonomy for a child, it is for a partner. Because irrespective, I think, of whether it is a traditional relationship or a parenting relationship, you are pretty much invested in that person. Now, you can, and I think to me, that's one of the benefits of a parenting partnership, is you can try and tailor that relationship for what works for both of you. And if it works for both of you to perhaps not be as full hands on a parent and the other person is,
right,
then maybe that's great. You right. know, maybe if people could have more of those sort of discussions before they had kids,
yes,
and realize, oh, actually, we're kind of being convinced by our oxytocin that we should have babies, not because we've both got the same world view of how we want to raise kids.
Right.
Then the world could perhaps be a better place.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, maybe that's just pie in the sky. It's sort of like Brave New World that I want the world to change this dramatically. And some yeah. people would say, well, you know what? There's not really anything wrong with the way it is right now. It works for some people and you just got to figure it out. And yeah. the people that figure it out and do the hard work, they figure it out.
Yeah, but you do have a choice to do it a different way. And mm-hmm. I think the way that you are doing it and the way you're taking your time
yeah.
and making sure that it's the right situation before you
right.
jump into it, and you are in a position to where you can have those kinds of discussions
right, right.
and figure it out ahead of time and see if it's a good match or
yeah.
not.
Now, because you've known me, as we said now, for what, 10 years, mm-hmm. a little bit longer than that. So you've known me in monogamous relationships, and you've obviously heard my sort of harebrained schemes and ideas about monogamy, non-monogamy, and parenting and having children.
Yes.
Where do you see me today? Do you think I'm in a good place? Do you think that I'm ready to move forward now as a parent? Or do you still think there's work that I need to do?
Like in terms of mentally?
Yeah, in terms of myself, yeah.
Oh, I would think you'd be ready.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because now, I feel like it's something that you are so dedicated to that I think you'd be an amazing father.
Oh, did you hear that? If you're listening to that, amazing father.
I really do.
Yeah, listen, you know, not to blow my own trumpet, but I do think I'd be a great dad as well.
Yes.
I've always felt I'd be a great dad. I just didn't think I'd necessarily be a great husband. Not because I'd be one of those awful husbands who drank or was away all the time, but just because it wasn't, I didn't want to be someone's husband for the rest of my life necessarily, right. you know?
Yeah.
But I did want to be someone's parent for the rest of my life. And I perhaps did want to be someone's partner,
mm-hmm.
but not in a traditional romantic monogamous relationship. And I didn't know there were any other options, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But you've, as I said, you've known me over these 10 years and you've seen me in monogamous relationships mm-hmm. and I've changed to some extent now. I mean, because I kind of really do feel like, I'm never saying never,
mm-hmm.
but I do feel like I'm not going to be in a monogamous relationship again.
Right.
I feel very happy being non-monogamous, yes. even though I realize that that means that I'll spend arguably a good portion of my life being celibate, because
right.
most girls, when you tell them that you're non-monogamous or even uh-huh. hint at it, they go, not for me.
Right.
I'll find somebody else who'll lie to me.
Right, that's how it works out usually.
Whereas if you're a girl and you tell guys you're non-monogamous, at least ostensibly at the beginning
yes,
they're very interested,
right?
But then
later on, not so much.
Not
sometimes.
So much when they see, yeah, so it's yeah. it's perhaps swings and roundabouts perhaps.
Yeah.
So that was Kat. We will get to the rest of the interview with her next week. Actually, after editing the interview, a question did occur to me that a couple of people asked me before that I didn't mention on the interview. Why, if we have the same views on monogamy and we both think we're attractive, did we never hook up? Mark Manson, again, explains it perfectly in his book. I didn't polarize her early on by expressing any sexual interest when we first hung out. See, according to Manson, girls are by and large neutral about most guys before they meet them, and will be polarized in one direction very quickly once they do by the way guys act or appear. And if a guy tries to be nice and more so non-sexual because they're afraid of being that creepy guy and of rejection, they will always polarize the girl away from being sexual into the friend zone. But to be honest, because I feel that our friendship is such a positive in my life, I'm perfectly okay with that. But again, maybe that's just a story I'm telling myself to avoid the hard work needed to change my life. Next week's interview, like I said, is the rest of the interview with Kat. Oh, we get into some good stuff.
A handsome man with a small child is very attractive.
Right. Yes.
Especially somebody who is there for the child and obviously dotes on it.
Exactly.
And taking care of it.
Chick bait.
And puts it first.
I like it. So I could take my little baby out to like a coffee shop and right. just sort of like dangle him around attractive girls and go, look, he's mine. I take care of him. I make right. sure he doesn't die. Want to make out?
Because people think that polyamory or non-monogamy is about sex and about getting to sleep with different people. But I see it's about freedom and it's about honesty and being able to authentically live whatever feelings you have in whatever moment with whoever you meet, rather than trying to deny part of yourself because you're trying to do the right thing in some way.
I'll see you next week. Well, that is it. Another week on this earth, another blessing. Thank you for listening and being part of my journey. Drop me a line if you have a comment or question, or if you think you know someone who'd be a good parenting partner for me. If you like the show, help spread the word, write a review, subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher so you don't miss an episode. I will be back next week, but until then, wherever you are and whoever you're with, be kind and happy. Let love rule. Hello.